hardback. So we find ourselves in the final two parshas of Chumash Shemos. Bayakel and Pekuda, we have them together this year. And we always have the sense, the cursory notion that they are, quote-unquote, just a repetition. What Terumah and Tetzaveh were for the instructions. Vayakel and Pekudei are for the construction. Yet as we will see, there is plenty to discuss from the vantage point of Vayakel and Pekudei, in addition to other matters. Specifically, of course, as we know, the Parsha of Vayakel, as much as almost all of it, is taken up with the construction of the Mishkan, but the opening two psukim are actually devoted to Shabbos. Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Gimel, Sheish Yes Yomim, Te'asim Melacha, on 6 days Melacha should be performed, V'Yom Yishvi Yelachem, Kodesh Shabbos Shabbos Nashim. And the question which must be asked is, Ma Inyan Shabbos Eitzel Mishkan? What is the message from the juxtaposition of Shabbos with the Mishkan? Well, as we know, the ruling is, and the teaching here, is that you have a conflict. You have the building of the Mishkan. Building of the Mishkan involves building. In fact, by definition, it involves everything that becomes Oser on Shabbos. The Lametes Melachos are learned from the Mishkan. And then you have Shabbos. So the question is, can one build the Mishkan on Shabbos? To that end, the Torah states that as much as there is a mitzvah to build the Mishkan, nonetheless, it is not Docha Shabbos. It's interesting, should we ponder, would we have thought that it would be Docha Shabbos? After all, it is a mitzvah, but on the other hand, Shabbos is very severe. Well, aspects of the mitzvah, in terms of its operation, routinely override Shabbos. The avoda of the Mishkan, in terms of its the most basic components, the hadlokas ha-menorah, and the ketores, and the two tamidim, and of course Shabbos, musaf of Shabbos itself by definition, they do override Shabbos, which means there would be ample reason to suspect, having already seen that aspects of the Mishkan are docha Shabbos, perhaps the building of the Mishkan are also docha, and to that end we need to be told that that is not the case. When it comes to the building of the Mishkan, 6 days a week, but not on the seventh. But what's interesting is, Mefarshim raised the question, Rishonim are wondering, how exactly are we sure that this is the message? After all we know is that the Torah presents Shabbos and the Mishkan one after the other. The message could be one of two ways. It could be, as we know is the case, that as much as there is a mitzvah to build the Mishkan, but not on Shabbos, that's why it mentions them together. Is it not possible that the exact opposite is true, that as much as there's an Isser to do Melacha on Shabbos, but when it comes to the Mishkan, it supersedes Shabbos? One of them has to hold sway, and how do we know that it is Shabbos? A simple enough question, and there's a very interesting answer, it's a very fine parshanut point, which is to be found in the Rishonim, Ramban, and Ibn Ezra. And they explain as follows. To understand the exact message here of Pasuk Beis and Gimel, dealing with Shabbos, we need to go back to Pasuk Aleph. And Pasuk Aleph reads, Vayakhel Moshe, Eskol Adas B'nei Yisrael, Vayomer Aleihem, Moshe gathers them, and says to them, Eile hadvarim asher tzivo Hashem la'asos osam. So these are words of introduction. These are the things, these are the words that Hashem, matters that Hashem has commanded to do them. Now, what exactly is Moshe introducing? Again, we're mindful of the fact that he's a book about two things. Briefly, Shabbos, and then largely, the Mishkan. Which of those two topics are being introduced with the words, Eile hadvarim? Says Ramban, it's very simple. Moshe introduces Eil Hadvarim Asher Tziva Hashem La'asos Osam. These are the things that Hashem is commanded to do. Well, of the two topics, Shabbos and Mishkan, now we know. Because Shabbos is defined, certainly, we're not talking about the mitzvah of Kiddush, it's defined by things that one cannot do. How then does the Pasuk say, Asher tziva Hashem la'asosavsam? Those words are clearly introducing the Mishkan, because the Mishkan are things to be done. Malachas and Shabbos are things not to be done. But if that's the case, then Pasuk Aleph is already talking about the Mishkan. If it's already talking about the Mishkan, as indicated by the words la'asosavsam, then that gives us new context for Pasuk Beis. For when Pasuk Beis now says, Sheshes yomim te'ase melacha, on 6 days one does work, but we've already begun talking about the Mishkan, we now know that the melacha that the Pasuk Beis is talking about is the melacha of the Mishkan that was introduced in Pasuk Aleph. And if that's the case, then if the Sheshes yomim te'ase melacha, the 6 days of melacha in Pasuk Beis, are melacha of doing the Mishkan, then when the Pasuk goes on to say, Uvayom Hashvi, Yelachem Kodesh, Shabbos Shabbos, and the seventh day is Shabbos, we now know that it's saying that for 6 days you build the Mishkan, but on Shabbos you rest from building the Mishkan. That is exactly how we get the lock, so to speak, on which is overridden by what. Okay, so that's classic Rishonim, Ramban, Ibn Ezra. But there is more to say here. It's interesting to note, throughout the Torah, very often certain averus can incur the gravest of penalties, misa, death. Sometimes the Torah says, if one violates this avera, you must, he'll be killed. And sometimes it says, mos you must, we would translate, he will surely be killed. Which is always a very difficult translation with that absolute infinitive, because if a person is killed, we're sure. It's not that we're unsure if it doesn't say it twice. And therefore, what is the difference between yumas as opposed to mos yumas? And which is a good shaila, that's a Lashon HaKodesh question. Ramban asks this question, and Ramban replies, the difference between them is because there are two capacities that a person can incur the death penalty. There is what's known as misas bezdin, right, which is a capital offense executed by the bezdin sentence. And there is what's known as misa bidei shamayim, where the Torah says this is beyond the scope, the jurisdiction of the bezdin. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of it. So there's misas bezdin and misa bidei shamayim. Says Ramban, this is the difference between the two terms. When the Torah says, if something happens, if a person does the following, you must, just the word you must, that's referring to misa bidei shamayim. When it says, mos you must, that insistence means that bezdin are the ones that need to take action, that's misas bezdin. For example, in Parshas Mishpatim, when it talks about an ox that gores and kills someone, so the Pasuk states, Hashor Yisakel, the shor itself, the ox is stoned, that's the famous Shor HaNiskal. Hashor Yisakel, Vegam Ba'alav Yumas. And also the owner of the ox, Yumas. Now, that's not halacha in operational terms. The Bezdin do not kill the owner of the ox, but the Pasuk says, Vegam Ba'alav Yumas. Rather, says Ramban, what that means is, Yumas, not Bidei Adam, the one Yumas. That's Bidei Shamayim. On the contrary, the halacha is that he needs to ransom himself by giving some type of compensation to the family of the victim. But that's an example of the Torah says, you must, just the one, and it means bidei shamayim. Another example, in Chumash Bamidbar, Parshas Korach, where it talks about the prohibition against non-Kohanim entering into the premises of the Mishkan, it states, V'hazar zar, an alien, a non-Kohen, V'hazar hakarev, yumas, also he will be killed. That's not a misas bezdin. Bezdin don't put a person to death for entering into the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash. Once again, it's the one term, and it refers to bidei shamayim. Now, having established that, we actually have a shaila in the beginning of our parsha. For go back to Pasuk Beis. Sheishes yomim te'asa melacha. Uvayom hashvi yelachim kodesh Shabbos Shabbos and Hashem. What happens if a person violates Shabbos? Says the Pasuk. Kola osa bo melacha. You must. The person performs a malacha on Shabbos, you must. Now, this is inconsistent with what we know. For Shabbos is actually Misas Bezdin. It's punishable by the Sanhedrin. But our formula tells us that the one word you must means bidei shamayim, but that doesn't work out. This is a question of Meshech Chochmah. And he gives a wonderful answer. To understand the use of the one term you must, said Meshech Chochmah, takes us on a bit of a tour of Torah, as he was known, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen, Sar HaTorah. See, in Parsha Shoftim, dealing with all the cases that are too difficult for the local Beis Din, so what do? Ki palei mimcha davar la'mishpat, if you're not sure how to handle a case, v'kamta v'alisa, you go up to Yerushalayim, to the Beis Din HaGadol Sheb Yerushalayim. It says, v'kamta v'alisa, uvasa el ha-kohanim, you come to the Kohanim, ve'al ha-shofet, asher yiyeh bayamim ha-hem. Come to the Kohanim, come to the judges. And the Gemara asks the question, if you have a legal question, why are you coming to the Kohanim? What is the role of the Kohanim in this situation? If you want to bring a Korban, go to the Kohen. But if you want to ask a Shaila in Halacha, you go to the Sanhedrin. So you should make a beeline straight for the Shofet. But the Pasuk says, come to the Kohanim, and then come to the Shofet. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Nun Beis, the message here is that the ability or the license of the Sanhedrin to execute Mishpat contingent upon the presence of the Kohanim. That's very interesting. In the words of the Gemara, Bizman sheyesh kohen, yesh mishpat. Bizman sheein kohen, ein mishpat. When it says you come to the Kohanim, you don't come to the Kohanim with your shaila, but the Kohanim need to be practicing, the Kohanim need to be involved in the Avodah, in order for the Sanhedrin to be allowed to answer your question. Now Rambam in Hilchas Sanhedrin explains that this refers specifically to the most sensitive of areas, of dinei nefashos, of capital cases. And what we see here is that the Torah only entrusts this area of halacha to the Sanhedrin when the Beis HaMikdash is functioning, so to speak, with all engines. Not only the Sanhedrin, but also the Beis HaMikdash. One needs a great deal of divine presence in order to handle these cases correctly. Okay. This is a very interesting halacha for us. All of a sudden, it is not a given. It's not immediate and always true that even if there's a Sanhedrin there, they can try capital cases. One needs the presence of at least a Mishkan or a Beis HaMikdash. Says Meshech Chochmah, this will explain for us an age-old question. As we know, in last week's Parsha, Parshas Kisisa, when Moshe comes down and there were people who were involved with the Egel and some of them were executed. I mean, it was a disastrous situation. Moshe says to them, Kichu ish charbo, ivu vashuvu, mishar lashar. That means that the execution of those who were involved in the Egel was by the sword. Kichu ish charbo. Now, that actually is unusual, because we know there's Arba Misas Bezdin, and each one has its own category, and the Aveira at stake here was Avodah Zarah, of course, for those 3,000 that were involved. And Avodah Zarah is not punishable by death by the sword. Avodah Zarah is punishable by what's known as Skila. And again, the person ends up dead either way, but there are Arba Misas Bezdin for a reason. So why did Moshe choose, so to speak, the incorrect form of Misas Bezdin? The Mefarshim point out that whereas it's true that there are four categories of Misas Bezdin for the Jewish people, but for Bnei Noah, who also have their mitzvahs, averus, and their consequences, a capital crime will always be by the sword. And that is meant to help us, because now we're meant to say that the reason why Moshe judged them by the sword and not by skila, not by stoning, is because he judged them as Bnei Noach, with a din of Bnei Noach and not with a din Torah. But the question is, well, why would he do that? I mean, they're not Bnei Noach anymore. They're Jewish, They didn't do a very Jewish thing with the Chet HaEgel, but they have to answer, presumably, bear the consequences in terms of Din Torah. Says Meshech Chochma. But now we understand. The Marechet, the system of Arba Misas Bezdin, as we have it, as the Chiddush of the Torah, we have seen, there's only Mishpat when there's Kohanim. The Sanhedrin can only dispense justice in that way when the Kohanim ba'avodosam. This is before the time of the Mishkan, and therefore we don't yet have the Arba Misas Bezdin. They haven't yet been activated as a new category. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu defaults back to the Bnei Noach, which will linger on until, as far as Misas Bezdin is concerned, until the Mishkan will be built. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, to come back to our question. We noted, Ramban has told us, the one word you must, that's in the hands of heaven. The double expression is Bidei Adam. Shabbos is Bidei Adam. And yet the Pasuk uses the one word, for the Oseba Malacha you must. Says Meshech Chochma, but now we understand, based on the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra, that we mentioned, which we mentioned before, that we're dealing specifically, the context has been set by Pasuk Aleph, we're dealing with the building of the Mishkan. If you're dealing with the building of the Mishkan, then by definition, the Mishkan is not yet functioning. If it's not yet functioning, you don't yet have Kohanim ba'avodasam, and therefore there is no Mishpat as far as the Torah is concerned. And if there's no Mishpat for Torah, for Dinei Nefashos, so then he won't be killed at all. Bnei Noach are not chayav to keep Shabbos. And that is why in this is the only case in the Torah where the penalty for violating Shabbos is the one term you must, because it's specifically time-stamped as being before the operation of the Mishkan. That is a wonderful observation, the delicacy of the terminology here, and Meshech Chochma is there to explain it for us. Elsewhere we find the Torah always says, Kala'osa b'malacha, Kala'osa b'malacha b'yom Shabbos, mos you must. That's when it's talking about Shabbos l'doroseichem. I'd just like to add a suggestion. I would have liked to have checked it more and perhaps to... But nonetheless, the moral of the story for us, and so the beginning of Vayakhel is, we're being told, the building of the Mishkan does not override Shabbos. Okay, that's important to know. Otherwise, how would you know? But the question is, as many Mepharshim raise, we do know. Because we've already been told this very same message in last week's parsha. In Kisisa, when first it talks about the Mishkan, and then presents Shabbos, V'shom b'bnei Yisrael es ha-Shabbos, it's Achas Shabbos es ha-Tishmeru, it's there, Rashi tells us from the Midrash, to teach us that you can build the Mishkan, but not on Shabbos. Which means the entire beginning of Parshas Vayakhel seems to be redundant. We're being told a message that we've already been told last week in Parshas Kisisa. Why are we being told again? I wonder whether it's possible to suggest that the reason why we're being told again is because events that intervened between the first time the message was given and now would perhaps have us think that the building of the Mishkan does override Shabbos, notwithstanding the fact that we were told that it originally told that it doesn't. And this is based on the position of the Ramban. It's a well-known machlokus, Rashi and Ramban, as to how to understand the chronological sequence of events of the Egel versus the Mishkan. According to Rashi, there was no talk of the Mishkan until the Egel, which means he invokes a muktam ma'ucha batorah. The contents of Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh were said after the Chet HaEgel. That's Rashi's position. Ramban, as we've noted on many occasions, is always very reluctant to use the concept of a muktam ma'ucha batorah unless absolutely necessary. And here he doesn't see it as necessary. Rather, says Ramban, initially the plan was to go straight from Matan Torah to the Mishkan, and they're already told about it. Things got disrupted. In the interim, Egel happened, and therefore the Mishkan is shelved for a while. They need to recover from the Egel and then get back again to Vayakhel Pekudi, and then the Mishkan comes back in play. Now, even according to the Ramban, and many Mepharshim point this out, that the idea of the Mishkan and the function of the Mishkan and the value of the Mishkan and the goal of the Mishkan is self-sufficient. That is to say, it's not a response to the Egel. It pre-existed the Egel. That may be true. But it is also true that once the Egel's happened, the Mishkan will not be the same. That is to say, it will now take on aspects of recovery from the Egel, that's for sure. It didn't need to have them initially, but it will have them now. And there are many ways that this can be perceived. But what we do see is that having made the Egel, the recovery of the Jewish people is not fundamentally complete. Their rehabilitation is not complete until they've made the Mishkan. Now, recovering from the Egel is of national concern. We see, for example, the Vilna Gaon, famously in his Perush to Shir HaShirim, tells us that the Anane HaKovod, for example, disappeared when after the Egel. They didn't come back until various stages of the Mishkan. Without the Anane HaKovod, the Jewish people are vulnerable. They're vulnerable to the elements of the desert. They're vulnerable to hostile neighbors. All of these now become possibilities. The Jewish people are at risk as a nation in a way that they weren't before the Egel. And they might not be again until after they've made the Mishkan. Therefore, perhaps we may say that last week before the Egel, so the building of the Mishkan is its own enterprise. And one can do it, but not on Shabbos. Because why should it be Docha Shabbos? It's a mitzvah, but it's not Docha Shabbos. But we need to be told again. Because by this time we come to make the Egel, it's no longer just, quote-unquote, a mitzvah. It's potentially pikuach nefesh. Because if the Jewish people are at risk as a nation, then to place them into a state of stability may well be sakonas nefashos. And pikuach nefesh is docha Shabbos. And therefore, that may be why it needed to be reinforced. That as much as it has this pikuach nefesh element, they will need their recovery nonetheless. The Torah emphasizes a second time that it's not Docha Shabbos. Come Shabbos, you put it to the side, and no harm will come. So that is something I believe worth our consideration. Now, if we talk about the concept of Shabbos generally in Parshas Vayakhel, there is one aspect of Shabbos which is highlighted specifically in this Parsha, and that is one of the 39 Malachas, the Malacha of carrying. And the reason why is because, according to the Gemara, although, generally speaking, we learn the 39 malachas from the Mishkan, so look at the Mishkan and then reflect off that to Shabbos, but the malacha of carrying has its own source. It has an independent source. And the reason why is because carrying is the malacha that's least likely to be perceived as a malacha. When it takes an item from A to B, nothing seems to have changed, and therefore it needs to be emphasized that it is as much a malacha, with all the severity that goes with it, with the other 38 malachas. What is the source of the issur of carrying? So the Gemara in the beginning of the 11th Perek of Masechet Shabbos derives it from Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Vav. The Jewish people are bringing materials to the Mishkan, and they have enough. I think it's the only shul in history where they said they had enough and told people to stop bringing. Vayitzav Moshe, Pasuk Vav, Vayaviru Kol B'machaneh Limor, they sent out an announcement. Ish v'isha al yasu od melacha l'trumas HaKodesh. No more melacha. And Vayikalei Ha'am Mehavi. People stopped bringing. Says the Gemara, you see from there that to bring from their homes to Moshe is a melacha. When Moshe says no more melacha, people stop bringing, because coming from their private residence through the Rosh HaSarabim, the public thoroughfare to Moshe, that itself is a malacha. And the malacha of carrying from private to public and vice versa easily has more space devoted to it in Masechet Shabbos, many times over, in fact, in some cases, than any of the other malachas. There's many, many details, a great deal to say. What I wanted to discuss very briefly, and again, not in a halacha lemaisa way, but just in terms of an appreciation of the background, which we sometimes do, is an appurtenance to the malacha of hotzah, which is very prevalent, and that is the idea of an eruv. Now, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to an eruv, and we're only going to focus on one aspect for this evening. But in terms of the background, the Gemara tells us, in Masechet Eruvin, that the idea of an Eruv is one of the earliest takonos that we have. It's a takonos from the time of Shlomo HaMelech, Shlomo is metaken Erevin and Netilas Yadayim. So it goes way back. And it's for that reason that it is not acceptable for a person to say, I don't hold of Erevs. He can't say that as a matter of principle, because if he does, that puts him against the takana of Shlomo HaMelech. In principle, it must exist. What is possible for him to say is that the way I understand how an Erev works, I'm not so happy with this Erev. But to say as a matter of religious policy, I don't hold of Erevin as a concept, that's unacceptable. It's actually, it'll be apikorsus. For some reason, Erevin are something of a magnet of for machlokas, which of course is ironic, as an Erev is meant to really bring people together. It's very often a divisive issue, as long as it's l'shem shamayim. Okay. But I'd like to discuss one of the most important questions that are one of the reasons why Eruvim are subject often to different responses and reactions. And it relates to the definition of what is called a public thoroughfare. What is a Rishus HaRabim? And the reason why that's important is because a Rishus HaRabim, a public thoroughfare, on a Torah level, it can be dealt with by an Eruv. But the type of Eruv that you'd need is much more concrete, so to speak, than the type of Eruv that you commonly find. Many places rely on an Eruv, which is essentially a series of doors. If you don't know the background to it, it looks like you hang up a wire and everything is okay. Why is it okay? I mean, what is that wire? So the thought behind it is that every building has doors. Now the doors, obviously, one is able to go through them, they're open spaces, that's not considered to be a breach in the enclosure. I mean, a door is part of the enterprise, it's part of the structure. So if a door is part of the structure, so could it be that one could set up a series of doors? Because a door is okay. Now, of course, there's no structure anymore. There's just doors. But if you go with the principle that a door is also part of the building, so have a building made entirely of doors, that's really what it is. And therefore, the wire, and this is actually very important, if you look closely, it has to go on top of the pole, which is, at the very least, the skeletal, what's called Suras HaPesach. Now, making a wall out of doors, the consensus of the poskim is, that's only possible if you're not dealing with a public thoroughfare on a Torah level, on a Doraisa level. If it's Rishus HaRabim on a Doraisa level, doors are not going to help. People walk in and out the doors, they're not aware of anything. That's not sufficient. If it's a Rishus HaRabim on a Doraisa level, you'd need a fence. You'd need walls, and you'd probably want to be closing the doors and completely enclose it, at least at night. It's an altogether different type of undertaking. And therefore, it will be of the essence for us to try and define, so what is a Rishus HaRabim from the Torah? If I'm in one, doors will not help me. If I'm in less than that, perhaps on a Darabana level, then the doors will help, then the Tzuras HaPesach will help. Okay. Now there are certain aspects of Rishus HaRabim which are mentioned in the Gemara explicitly. For example, it's got to have a minimum width. It has to be 16 amos wide, which is 8 meters, which is not really that much. Okay, if it's less than that, it's not a Rishus HaRabim. Okay. Secondly, says the Gemara, it can't be roofed. If it's roofed, so then it's not a Rishus HaRabim. That already gives it a kind of a less than public aspect. When would we ever expect to find a public thoroughfare that's roofed? I mean, that's quite an extravagance. Except Poskim point out, what will happen if there's a bridge that's crossing over the width of the road? In a sense, could that constitute a roof? Could that disrupt its status as Rishus HaRabim? Okay.
Roof, you mean a roof? What was that?
A roof.
Roof.
Not in the Yekish sense, in the English sense.
Roof.
Now, there is a third defining characteristic, and this is the point of a great deal of controversy. It's not to be found in the Gemara, as our common editions have it, but it's to be found in the writings of one of the Gaonim, the Bahag, the Baal Halachas Gedolos. And his words have great weight. Whenever he speaks, everyone has to listen. And the Bahag says that another defining characteristic of public thoroughfare on a Torah level is it has to have the presence of 600,000 people. Now, that changes many situations, because there's a lot of streets that they're unroofed and they're more than 8 meters wide, but they don't, there's no 600,000 people there. So this could be very much, this could be decisive. That's the requirement of the Bahag. And Rashi quotes this on a number of occasions, even though, as we mentioned, it doesn't seem to be discussed in the Gemara. Well, isn't it discussed in the Gemara? Okay. The Tosfos say that one could argue that it is. The presence of 600,000 is discussed in the Gemara. From the beginning of Masechet Shabbos on Daf Vav, the Gemara brings conflicting rulings as to whether the wilderness, the Midbar, is that a Rosh HaRabim? Certainly open enough. In one teaching it says it's a Rosh HaRabim. In another teaching it says it's what's called a Carmelis. It's a rabbinic domain, but it's not a Rosh HaRabim on a Torah level. So which is it? Yes or no? Says the Gemara, it depends. When the Jewish people were there, it's a Rosh HaRabim. If you have a rabbim there, it's a Rosh HaRabim. When the Jewish people aren't there, so then it's Carmelis. It's not a Rosh HaRabim. And therefore, says Tosfos, this is support for what the Bahag is saying, that one of the defining characteristics of a public thoroughfare is the presence of a number of people equivalent to the Jewish people at the time, the 600,000. However, not everyone agrees to this argument of Tosfos, to this evidence. The Ramban states that it could be that the reason why the Gemara says you need the presence of the Jewish people is because the Jewish people aren't there. There's nothing there. I mean, it's a desert. It's a non-place. And therefore, you can't compare a town or a city, which may not have 600,000 people, but the public is there. I mean, people live there. People traverse there. Maybe there you don't need 600,000. In order to construct almost yesh me'ayin, a place out of no place, like the wilderness, then you'd need 600,000. But beyond that, in a normal urban setting, perhaps you wouldn't need it. And that's Ramban's response to that. It's interesting to note, Tosfos say, if we're taking our cue from the Jewish people in the Midbar, and we say there were 600,000, that there were plenty more than 600,000. There are 600,000 men from 20 to 60, right? But there's younger, there's women, there's older. That's at least double, two or three times, four times. So we should require, if we're going by the Jewish people, and that's our number, should be more than 600,000, which is a very interesting question. I mean, Tosa's answer is simply that in the absence of numbers, we can only go by the numbers that are explicit in the Torah, and therefore we pare it down to that minimal threshold of 600,000. Okay. Now, we've spoken so far quite generally, 600,000 people there. Where is there? I mean, where do they need to be? And here too, we find within the Bahag two possibilities. Some say it means 600,000 people living in the city, even though how many of them will be going through the road on any given day. Not all of them, I mean, they don't all take to the road, the same road every single day. But the 600,000 people live there, and a percentage of them will use the road. That's already Rosh HaRabim, the road that services a place where 600,000 people live. However, the Shulchan Aruch, as he presents the opinion of the Bahag, says that according to the Bahag, it's only Rosh HaRabim if 600,000 people overimbo, if they traverse, if they use the road, and all of a sudden that further marginalizes many places, because there's a lot of places 600,000 people live there, but they don't all use the road. It's got to be big enough that 600,000 people use the road. And moreover, says the Shulchan Aruch, to further emphasize here, the Chol Yom, every day. It has to be a road that's so busy and so used that as a matter of daily course, 600,000 people will pass through. It's getting harder and harder to find a Rosh HaRabim nowadays. And moreover, and this is very interesting, it's a post-Shulchan Aruch discussion, but you talk about people using the road. For us, that would be, what type of road? I mean, that's a highway, a main thoroughfare. But what's interesting is, who are these 600,000 people that use the road? The Maharsham, the great Rav Shlomo Mordechai HaKohen, one of the great poskim of the 1800s, said in his time that if you pass the road in a carriage, the carriage traffic doesn't count, because every carriage is its own Rishus HaYochid, and therefore they're not actually fully part of the Rishus HaRabim, which means by definition the type of road that's big enough will only be used by people that don't count. Although Rav Moshe Feinstein was not prepared to accept that, and he holds that for us, car traffic really would be part of the 600,000. So this is the basic presentation of the Bahag. Now, was the Bahag accepted? He has spoken, but is he taken on board? The Rambam, we should note, makes no mention of this requirement of 600,000, and there are other Rishonim who similarly do not mention it, Ramban, Rashba, and others. And therefore, although Rashi and Tosfos seem to have taken it on board, Rambam and his camp do not seem to recognize this. As long as it's 16 tefachim wide, that's a Rishus HaRabim already. And we should note that one of the great Ashkenazi Acharonim, the Mishkanes Yaakov, Rav Yaakov of Karlin, has a number of questions. He sides with the Rambam. Halachically, he comes down very firmly, like the Rambam, that you do not need 600,000 to turn it into Rishus HaRabim. And I mentioned just one or two of his questions. They're very powerful. They need to be responded to. Firstly, says the Mishkanes Yaakov, one of the first to rail about the problem of people carrying on Shabbos was the prophet Nehemiah. And they came back, and he describes the situation. People were not so learned, the ones that came back, and they didn't really know a lot of the halakhos of Shabbos correctly. And the Nehemiah says, and they're carrying in the streets on Shabbos. It's terrible. It was. Says Mishkanes Yaakov, how many people lived in Jerusalem at that time? How many Jews lived in Israel at that time? 600,000? We know from Ezra that 42,000 Jews came back. So you don't have 600,000. But Nehemiah is still very upset by the fact that they're carrying, and it sounds like it's the malacha of carrying. It's good shaila. Moreover, or additionally, says Mishkanes Yaakov, as we know, there are certain mitzvahs that when the day to perform them falls on Shabbos, we don't perform those mitzvahs. Amongst them, Shofar on Shabbos, Lulav on Shabbos, Megillah as well. Why not? There's a worry. The worry is, says the Gemara, that a person may take them, he may not be exactly familiar with the halachas, he may take them and walk 4 amos in Rishus HaRabim. That's carrying. It's severe enough to suspend the entire mitzvah nationwide. The only exception for blowing shofar was a city that has a Beis Din. City that has a Beis Din, the halacha is a proper Beis Din with a Sanhedrin. They could. Says Mishkanes Yaakov that we know that halacha, Yom Tov falls on Shabbos, you don't blow shofar, don't take lulav. Why? You may come to carry. Now, that's a protection against the malacha of carrying. But if we say that the definition of a public thoroughfare requires 600,000 people, that means it's very rare to find an example of a Rishus HaRabim. And we have a principle. The rabbis do not enact a protective measure to protect against something that is so rare, what's called milsa de lo shchicha, which is very uncommon. According to the definition of the Baal Halachas Gedolos, Rishus HaRabim is a milsa de lo shchicha. It's rare to find Rishus HaRabim. So why would you suspend the mitzvah? To protect against it. For most people, they'll never be in Rishus HaRabim. And just to cement the question, and if they are in a place that's big enough to be a Rishus HaRabim, it probably has a Sanhedrin in it, in which case it's mutter anyway. So these are two very high octane questions of the Mishkanes Yaakov. I believe they need don't need to respond to them. You need to recover from them. And there are responses. Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolius and the Beis Ephraim has a long, lengthy tshuva where he takes on the Mishkanes Yaakov point for point. So this is a bit of the background, and how do things fall on a practical plane? Well, Tor, not surprisingly, who represents the Ashkenazi Rishonim, he states, as a matter of course, that in order to be a Rishus HaRabim, it needs 600,000 people. And that's the Bahag gets entry into the Tor was no problem. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, also mentions the Bahag, but he doesn't give him the stage that the Torah did. The Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Shin Mem Hei Siv Zayin, what's a Rishus HaRabim? It's got to be 16 Amos wide, can't be roofed. V'yesh Omrim, and some say it's got to have 600,000 people going through it every day. Now, Yesh Omrim means some say, but the question is, but does the Shulchan Aruch say? I mean, that he didn't mention it as unanimously as the others. And the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch seems to be that he does not accept it, which again is not surprising. The Rambam didn't mention it. And therefore, it seems to be, if we would use generalities, that the Torah and the Ramah also accepts the Bahag, which means that most streets nowadays would not be Rishus HaRabim on a Torah level, and the Shulchan Aruch seems to not require it, and therefore he would be more inclined to see them as Rishus HaRabim. And it's for this reason that Sfardim are traditionally more machmir when it comes to Eruvin. Because as we've said, if you're going to use the wire, which is a doorway, that only work, presumably, if the Rishus HaRabim is not on a Doraisa level. But if you don't need 600,000, it's very easy. Most cities, their streets will be Rishus HaRabim on a Doraisa level. So it's the Pesach won't help. You need more to it than that. The Mishnah Brura himself, who for us, we normally consider to be the final word, the Mishnah Brura cautions against relying on an Eruv in a large city that's only based on the wires, on the Tzuras HaPesach. He says you can't protest if people use it, which is also important, because protesting is half of the work of Eruvin. But for those that are relying on it, you can't protest, but he recommends that the Baal Nefesh Yachmir. However, those that came after the Bir Halacha still persisted in establishing the Ashkenazi minhag, certainly, are relying on the requirement of 600,000, which essentially means that we don't consider our streets to be a Rishus HaRabim. One of the most famous Eruvin, which everyone takes a great interest in, was the Eruvin Warsaw, because Warsaw was quite a metropolis, and it was known that Warsaw had an Eruv that was based on Tzuras HaPesach, and that also is now something to be reckoned with, because Warsaw was teeming with Talmidei Chachamim, and no one seemed to have a problem with it, and that is brought in evidence, unless you can explain otherwise, that we seem to accept the Bahag and therefore use the Tzuras HaPesach. So this is a bit of the background. Of course, there's plenty of other details, perhaps Od Chazon LaMoed. If we can take the suspense, we'll discuss other aspects of it on another occasion. So to the Mishkan, having discussed Shabbos, we're trying to move past the first three psukim of these two parshas. I'd like to spend our final moments by discussing a well-known and much-discussed phenomenon within these parshas, namely the repetition of a certain phrase again and again, that is, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. It appears no less than 18 times, which is a lot. And once would have sufficed. In fact, the Yerushalmi, interestingly, states, Yerushalmi in Brochas, that the Shmonasre Brochas, our Shmonasre, the 18 blessings, were corresponding to the 18 times that it says, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. So it sets a certain template. And many people have what to say about these 18 repetitions. However, the discussion isn't entirely accurate until we realize that almost all of these phrases occur not in Parshas Vayakhel, dealing with the Mishkan and its Kelim, but in Parshas Pekudei, dealing with the Big Day Kahuna. If you look in Parshas Vayakhel, you won't find it. And in Pekudei, it keeps every three or four psukim, it comes back again and again, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. So the question is, why is it there such a repetition with regards to the Big Day Kahuna and almost none with regards to the Mishkan? That's the question. And this matter is addressed by Reb Velvel Soloveitchik. And again, we see the precision and the thoroughness of the Parshanut. It's something to behold. When we say Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, the word mitzvah has a specific connotation. We say mitzvah means commandment, and it does. But as far as the Gemara is concerned, the Torah will not use the word mitzvah Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Kaftes, unless it persists for future generations. If it's a one-time thing, that's not called a mitzvah. Mitzvah is miyad uladoros. That's our working definition now for a mitzvah. It's got to be something which is true not only for now, but also for future times. Okay. Now what does this have to do with us? In the beginning of Parshas Truma, the Pasuk states, V'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'socham, k'chol asher ani mareh oscha, in accordance with everything I'm showing you, tavnis ha-mishkan, v'es tavnis kol kelav, the form of the mishkan and its vessels, v'chein ta'asu. And so you shall do. Now, these two words, v'chein ta'asu, seem to be neither here nor there. I mean, the Pasuk began by saying, V'asuli mikdash. V'chein ta'asu, and so you shall do. They seem distended somewhat. What do they mean? Rashi comments. Rashi says, "B'chein ta'asu l'doros." In all future generations, just like I showed you here, so you shall do, not only now, but also in future generations. But the Ramban disputes. Ramban takes issue with Rashi. And Ramban says that that's not necessarily true. It's a fascinating position of Ramban. It could be that the specific tavnis, the form of the Mishkan and its kelim, the Torah only insists upon it for the Mishkan. But Ladoros and the Beis HaMikdash, you'll have the same kelim. Do they need to be done in exactly the same form? Not necessarily. Now, we will understand, in the position of Ramban, and therefore Ramban explains the words V'chein Tasu differently. It's not about the Doros. Of course, we understand, says Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, the Ramban does not mean to say that in future generations, you don't need these kelim. You do. The Beis HaMikdash will always need a menorah, a shulchan, and two mizbechos. But they don't necessarily need to be made with the exact specifications as we find in Parshas Truma. That's quite a major statement. And in fact, says the Brisker Rav, this explains to me something which otherwise would be very difficult. When it comes to the making of the menorah, well, the Medrash tells us, and Rashi quotes it, that Moshe found it almost impossible to envisage. I mean, how could the menorah be made in that way? Indeed, Rashi quotes, the Medrash says, that the menorah was made by itself. Miksha te'aseh, in the passive. Because it's almost impossible for a person to make the menorah with all of those specifications. Kaftarim, prachim, from one piece of gold. Rashi says, he threw it into the fire, it came out a menorah. Well, that's good if you can do it. But in future generations, we find, for example, in Shlomo HaMelech, in the first Beis HaMikdash, he didn't have that fire. He didn't have that extra curricular help. It was just him. How was he able to do what Moshe couldn't do? And the second Beis HaMikdash also. Rather, according to the Ramban, it could be, it seems, that the menorah is okay even if you don't make it to the precisions that were mentioned in Parshas Truma. If you need the Parshas Truma Dika menorah, throw it into the fire. And if you're Moshe Rabbeinu, it will come out the right way. But for future generations, maybe you can't make it that way with all the kaftarim, givim from one piece of gold. So they didn't. Especially, just to further accentuate this point, the Hanukkah story. So, what's well known is that the Yevonim v'timu kol hashmonim, right? They were metame of the oil. So, if you're metame the oil, you can't use the oil. What's not so much discussed is that they were also metame the menorah. So now what? Which means any pure oil that you put in will instantly become tame. It's for that reason that Rishonim say that the Chashmonaim didn't use the menorah. The existing menorah. They made a new menorah. Now, time is of the essence. How feasible is it that on that day, just between the war and the time for lichbenching, they made a menorah that Moshe had to throw it into the fire, and who knows how long it would take? That would be a miracle on a par with the miracle of the oil, to be able to fashion a menorah in a matter of hours. They didn't. But how is the menorah kosher? Because it's kosher. Where are the flowers and where are the givim? It's kosher without it. B'dievet, certainly. Okay. And certainly the Mishkan itself, we know, does not persist l'doros. The Beis HaMikdash isn't formed like the Mishkan at all. It's not made of beams. It's not made of coverings. It's a building. That's far with regards to the Mishkan. However, when we talk about the Bigdei Kehuna, by contrast, there is no such indication that for future generations they'll be in any way different than the way they are described in Parshas Tetzaveh. The tzitz needs to always look like it looks in Parshas Tetzaveh. So does the Me'il, and so does everything else. And therefore, says the Brisker Rav, now we understand why the Torah only uses the expression Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe with regards to Bigdei Kehuna. Because Tziva, with the full connotation of what Tziva means, is not only at that time, but this is how it was meant to be for future generations. That's true for all of the Bigdei Kehuna. It's not true for any of the Kelim of the Mishkan. And that's amazing Parshanut. The question is, do we ever find this expression used with regards to the Mishkan? Once. We turn to the beginning of Parshas Pekudei. Pasuk Perek Lamed Ches Pasuk Kaf Beis. Salel ben Uri ben Hur Lamate Yehuda Asa Es Kol Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. You do find it once. Okay. Is that acceptable? Does that rest well with what we're saying? Says the Brisker Rav. Absolutely. Because when you're talking about the totality of the Mishkan, when you're talking about the components of the Mishkan, that is Lidoros. The future Beis HaMikdash will need a Shulchan. It will need a menorah. It will need the Mizbechus. And therefore, in a general way, it is true that there was a Tzivoy. That Tzivoy is V'asuli Mikdash, which is the source of the mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, it works out perfectly. That if Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe refers to future generations, that they should also be the same. It is mentioned by every individual item for Bigdei Kehuna because it's true of every item 18 times, and it's mentioned generally about the Mishkan because it is true generally about the Mishkan that one time. And in his final, this is the pièce de résistance of Rav Elwell Soloveitchik, he says, look at Perek Lamed Tes Pasuk Aleph, and we will see the full impact of this idea. Lamites Pasuk Aleph. Uminatcheles v'argaman v'tolas hasheni, from all of those dyed walls, etc. Asu bigdei asrad l'shareis b'kodesh. They made what's called bigdei sarad, which we'll come back to in just a moment. Vayasu es bigdei akodesh asher la'aron kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe. So what were these materials used? The tcheles, the blue wool, and the purple wool, and the tolas hasheni, the silk. What were they used for? Two things. Bigdei Sarad and Bigdei Kodesh for Aaron. Now, given that the same materials were used for these two types of clothing, or these two types of Bigodim, the Pasuk splits it up into two, as if they're two separate discussions, but they're the same. The Pasuk should have said, Uminatcheles Vargaman Betolah Shani Asu Bigdei Sarad L'Shareis B'Kodesh B'Bigdei HaKodesh Asher La'Aron. But it closes the first discussion and then opens up a new discussion within the same pasuk. New thing. Vayasu Es Bigdei HaKodesh Asher La'Aron Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. Why does it open these two channels when we're talking really about the same materials? Says Avvel, well, the reason why is because it is only about one of these two types of garments that you can say Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. The first begot mentioned are Bigdei Sarad. What are Bigdei Sarad? They're not the Bigdei Kehuna. They're mentioned later on. What the Bigdei Sarad, Rashi tells us in Parshas Kisisa, is that we know when they moved the Mishkan from place to place, they would have various materials to cover over the kelim, and that's described at length in Parshas Bamidbar. Those are the Bigdei Hasrad. And now, says Rav Elwell, let's ask the question. Of these two types of bigodim, the coverings for the kelim and the clothing for the kohanim, which of them will be part of the Beis HaMikdash, Ledoros? Not the first, They didn't. There's no transport in the Beis HaMikdash. There are no Big Day Hasrat in the Mikdash. There are Big Day Kahuna. And therefore, although materials are the same, the Pasuk splits them up into two. Because it wants to use the expression Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, but Kasher Tziva Es Ledoros. That's not true of both of these categories. It's only true of the second. And therefore, it's a self-contained description of Big Day Hasrat, and that's finished, and then a new thing. So the Brisker Rav has swept through the Parsha here, and he's explained exactly when this phrase is used with regards to what, sometimes generally, sometimes particularly, and sometimes even to prize apart two aspects within the same Pasuk, all of it explained Kedark. I'd just like to conclude for a moment by pondering the role of, the end of Chumash Shemos, Vayakel Pekudei. The Mishkan is made, and that's the end of Chumash Shemos. How is this the end of the Chumash? How is this the conclusion of how the Chumash began? And Ramban discusses this in his Hakdama to Shemos, and I would like to perhaps add something, a suggestion. Chumash Shemos is Chumash HaGeula. The Chumash of redemption. When has redemption happened? Well, that's a major question. There could be more than one answer to that. The full answer is redemption isn't complete until we're in Eretz Yisrael, but you can't wait for Chumash Shemos for us to enter Eretz Yisrael. It happened after the entire Torah was finished. So Chumash Shemos can't hold out for that. So there has to be a milestone or a landmark fulfillment or realization of what Geula is. And that realization comes in the building of the Mishkan. And Ramban says, because that's when the Shekhinah came back, and that's the fundamental Geula. But just to add an additional feeling, Mitzrayim, according to the Sifrei Chassidus, is not just a place. Mitzrayim is a state. The word Meitzar means a boundary, a constriction. Min ha-Meitzar karasika. The concept of being in Mitzrayim is the Jewish people were essentially reduced to nothing. To being worth nothing, to being capable of nothing, and therefore Geula from Mitzrayim takes the form not only of geographically leaving, but of being capable of great things. That's leaving Mitzrayim, that's leaving their boundaries, that's leaving their handicaps, and they... Who made the Mishkan? The Pasuk says, who came forward? Called Ish Asher Nissa'o Libo. Some Mefarshim say that refers to people who volunteered materials. But Ramban says, Nissa'o Libo, he has wonderful words, we don't have time now to read them inside, but on that Pasuk in Vayakel, Nissa'o Libo is not a reference to people donating materials, it's about people coming forward to do the Mishkan. The Mishkan is a work of such delicacy, it's an enterprise of such detail. What are the qualifications of the Jewish people to undertake such a thing? Bezalel hadn't opened yet. They have no qualifications. What have they been doing? They've been working with bricks and mortar. That's nothing compared to what they'll need. What did they have? Says Ramban, they had one thing. Nissa'o libo. Their heart raised them up. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said they can do it. Everything, their whole experience in Mitzrayim is telling them, you can't do it. You're worthless and useless. But they left Mitzrayim. And they said, we can. And because they thought they could, Hashem blessed their efforts, and the Mishkan came out. And that's the end of Chumash Shemos. Because that's a landmark in Geula. In terms of leaving Mitzrayim, because Mitzrayim is defining what you're incapable of doing, so then the discovery of just how much they were capable of doing, Vayikba Libam Badarchei Hashem, that's a fitting end to Yetzias Mitzrayim, and a fitting closing for Chumash Shemos. We'll leave it there with that.